I'll just move on to introducing our speakers. We've actually got two speakers, apart from what we've said in the notes. You get two for the price of one. Tomo Lincoln, who's a member of Socialist Alternative, who's been interested in following the issues in Indonesia for a long time now, is going to just say a few words at the beginning, and then we will pass over to Mahendra. I want to say a few things just to introduce Mahendra. I was lucky enough to do this. He did a meeting for us in Sydney a couple of weeks ago on his way here. And Mahendra has been an activist since the 1990s. He got involved in the campaign to bring down the Suharto dictatorship in 1997 when he was a high school student. He's been very active around a whole series of issues to do with the struggle in Indonesia basically since that time. He, for example, was sentenced to 3 years jail for, what was it, insulting the government? Insulting the government, which is a crime. And he served 2 years and 6 months and 10 days of that 3 years. And then I think the most wonderful thing, not only did he endure imprisonment, did he write a book with another comrade while he was imprisoned, but also the first thing that he did, I think this is so marvellous, the first thing that he did when he got out of jail was to lead a demonstration outside the jail. So, and I think he needs no further introduction. So I'll pass over to Tom first and then Mahendra.
I just want to make a couple of comments because it occurred to me that perhaps we should reflect a little bit on why we invite international speakers and why we invited this particular international speaker and the whole issue of, you know, international solidarity that's associated with it. Because I think the first impulse people have is to think, gee, they've got it tough in Indonesia. You know, they haven't got any money and they're fighting on a shoestring and, you know, we should raise money for them and help them out. And I think that's absolutely right. We should raise money for them and help them out. And they are fighting on a shoestring and that's very admirable. But it's only the start of it. The next thing that perhaps a little bit closer to, I think, the key issues is we say to ourselves, they're so brave in Indonesia, what they're up against. I mean, I've been on the fringe of in demonstrations in Indonesia once in a while and see the Indonesian police lined up, and the military lined up. You know, it's kind of scary. And I was arrested. I see someone, there's Max Lanes here. We were arrested together in Jakarta once, and I was held for 24 hours, and I dined out on that for about 9 years. This guy's been in jail for 3 years, and as soon as he gets out, he joins a demonstration. He leads a demonstration. That was story improved. I mean, so it's absolutely right. They are incredibly brave in Indonesia, and they do deserve our support, and they should be tremendously interesting to us because of the bravery that they show in Indonesia. But even so, that's really only the beginning. That really makes it sound like we're kind of helping them out. And isn't that sort of nice of us to help them out? But really, the reason we should be involved with the comrades in Indonesia, just in many other places as well, of course, is that they're our allies in the struggle against the same enemies. They're our allies in the struggle against their ruling class and our ruling class. And I just wanted to relate a couple of little episodes that I think illustrate that. And the first is during World War II. Australian soldiers were marched up into eastern Indonesia towards the end of World War II to facilitate the return of the Dutch colonialists, the Dutch colonial power. And it was successful, and they did in fact facilitate the return of a Dutch butcher called Paul Westerling, who would go into villages and line people up and shoot people until they told them where the independence fighters were and so on. It did, the effort was successful, but not without tremendous resistance from the Indonesians, but also from Australian soldiers. There are documented cases where the records show there was a mass meeting of Indonesians and there were 10 or 15 Australians turned up there. Very interesting to ask ourselves, what were they doing there? Probably there was a collective organizing process going on. And later on, of course, you're more likely to have heard of the black bands that were placed on Dutch ships for Indonesia as part of the support for the independence movement. What you may not know is that the preceding history to that in Australia was a campaign by Indonesians in prison, effectively in detention in Australia, eventually got out of detention, but a campaign of people who had been political prisoners in Indonesia who were transferred to Australia, who then campaigned throughout Australian society. And that's a lot of the background to the bans on Dutch ships. So once again, it's not just Australians are really nice to help people out. You know, it was a campaign by the Indonesians themselves. It was a joint campaign between Australian leftists and Indonesian leftists to make that happen. More recently, we had, as I recall, industrial action by the waterside workers in defense of Dita Sari, an Indonesian trade unionist who was imprisoned And then during the MUA dispute, the Maritime Union of Australia dispute, not too long after that, which was an Australian industrial dispute, there was action, I believe, in Surabaya by Indonesians demonstrating their support for the Australian trade union movement. So the purpose of bringing people here is not just to have a, you know, a feel-good exercise or whatever about how brave they are. It is about building the practical cooperation, about making that alliance stronger. And finally, of course, it's about learning from experiences and exchanging ideas. And that, of course, is our key task today. And I'll hand over now to Mahendra.
Okay. So in order to first understand the working class struggle in Indonesia, and we first need to look at the history and the objective condition today, because history is what shapes the working class movement in Indonesia and give us a the main point that give us the perspective for the future, for the struggle to the future. Historical understanding combined with facts of the subjective and objective condition of the labor movement today will be the instrument in determining the next step of the movement toward its victory. So I will go a little bit about the workers' movement and the working class condition during the military regime from 65 until 98. So Suharto rise to power after killing millions of people allowed Indonesian society to be redesigned in the interest of international capital with the military regime as its right hand. The first step was dividing Indonesian wealth among the multinational corporations that shaped natural resources and cheap labor. American Freeport got copper mountains in West Papua. American and European consortium got nickel mine in West Papua. Alcoa company got the biggest part of Indonesian bauxite. A group of America, Japan, and France company control rainforest in Sumatra, West Papua, and Borneo. This was done in 1967, followed by a new debt and debt rescheduling. Then it was followed by a Foreign Investment Act that allowed 100% free tax for foreign investment in Indonesia. History also has shaped the Indonesian ruling class, the bourgeoisie, so that they have little character. When most of the world was in rush of gold, gospel, and glory, they preferred taking more tax, building palace, building nice building, and also adding more mistress. So in 65, when the imperialists came, they were very happy to become a puppet regime and take crumbs from the imperialists. The second step taken to redesign Indonesia was a de-ideologization and demobilization process in the Indonesian labor movement, reducing the people to a depoliticized floating mass, keep them out of politics and mass mobilization. They were confined to doing everyday work under the system called Pancasila Industrial Relations. So Pancasila Industrial Relations was a concept of harmonious, family-based principle. Workers, capital, and the state were seen as a part of one big family, with the state playing as a role of benevolent father. It was presented as one that supposedly unique, suited to Indonesian culture and opposed to foreign-derived notion of class conflict. So Suharto regime established ministry decision about registration of trade union in 1975. The law made it very hard for working class to organize and consolidate the trade union. And Suharto's regime limited the labor movement by permitting only a single trade union called the All Indonesian Labor Federation, or Federasi Buruh Seluruh Indonesia. On March 1974, FBSI was legally admitted by the government as the only trade union. And then on 1985, when Suharto felt that FBSI chairperson no longer can be controlled, he changed FBSI to All Indonesian Trade Union. Suharto regime also banned May Day celebration and created its own Manpower Day. Even the word, because the word worker or labor was seen as related to communists, and so the regime had to change the ministry to labor to Ministry of Manpower. In 1989, a ministerial decision gave a legal basis for the military to play a role in labor affairs, particularly with regards to industrial dispute. So through this decision has been subsequently repealed, such a role continued to be condoned on the basis of 1990 policy established by the head of National Strategic Body. In that policy, the military apparatus at all levels was given early detection, preventive, and repressive function to control labor unrest. One of the fatal consequences of military involvement was the death of Marsina. So Marsina was a worker in a company called Catur Putra Surya in Eastern Java. So her body was found on May 8, 1993, after she led a demonstration in the factory. The death of Marsina was believed to be the responsibility of Sidoarjo District Military Command. So far, this human rights violation has still not been investigated properly. But Marsina was not the only one. For example, there is a worker named Rusli in North Sumatra was also killed by the police after joining a workers' demonstration in 11 March 1994. An awakening of the labor movement started in the early 90s. Trade unions were built up with support from non-workers such as students and activists and NGOs activists. In 1990, the Setiakawan or Solidarity Union was built. In 25 April 1992, a group of pro-democracy activists held a national workers' meeting in Cepayung, West Java. They then declared the All Indonesian Labor Union, or Serikat Buruh Seluruh Indonesia, with Mukhtar Papahan, a lawyer from Medan, as the first Secretary General. Beside that, a more political labor organization was built and called the Indonesian Center for Labor Struggle, Pusat Perjuangan Buruh Indonesia. So when a storm of economic crisis hit Indonesia in 1997, it started when Thailand's currency fell apart, then it swept all of Southeast Asia, then the rhetoric of ASEAN miracle destroyed the newly industrial countries, including Indonesia, that said they could compete with European and the US was collapsed in one night. In Indonesia, that crisis sparked a wave of protests dominated by the students. First there were demands to lower the price. Then after that, after a long series of struggle, then came political demands for Suharto resignation, the end of military role in politics, and referendum for East Timor. In cities across the country, thousands of student organizations grew up, and some tried to build a national network. The student movement was then joined by other sectors such as high school, urban poor housewife, etc. From my personal experience, I remember one of the famous saying at the time is, if you are a student but you never join a demonstration, then you are not a student. So the overthrow of the military regime brought some positive change for the working class, but it didn't change their condition fundamentally. There is some degree of freedom to build union, but welfare was hardly ever comes to the worker. This is mostly because the change fell into the hands of Indonesian bourgeoisie elite, which has no character and is inconsistent. It was not led by labor movement leadership. Since the reform period called reformasi, so a new era of exploitation began in Indonesia, known as neoliberalism. To understand this, first we have to analyze the industrial setting of Indonesia. What is the structure of industry? What is the character of industry and the neoliberal policy? What is the impact on the working class? Then we will look at the dynamics of working class struggle, especially the trade union, and what is the way forward in the future. So the condition in Indonesia is the national industry wasn't built with a strong foundation or a pro-people perspective. It's a weak in technology, production capacity, and ability to compete with foreign industry. Natural resources are not utilized optimally because national industry are slave to imperialist interests. That perspective is also reflected in industry that built in. It's export-oriented with import raw materials, while basic industry is controlled by multinational corporation. The industry that use high technology just combine processing, packaging, and assembly from imported material. And Indonesian industry is still dominated by small and middle industry. So neoliberalism in Indonesia got a firm foundation when Megawati came to power. She came to power with support from the military and right-wing groups in 2001 after ousting President Wahid, which also known as Gus Dur. So at the same time, she had lots of support from people hoping for change. But this is not because of a rational reason, but most of it is because due to the fact that she is the daughter of Sukarno, which is Indonesian first president, and he is very popular among grassroots people. But what Megawati did was actually intensifying the neoliberal policy. So Megawati's regime laid the legal foundation for capitalist exploitation based on cheap wage, casualization, and mineral wealth. She did this through the Labor Act 2003, Industrial Dispute Settlement Act 2004, and Oil and Gas Act in 2002. And also during her time, the level of repression intensified through arrest, jailing, and killing of activists. So the neoliberalism came through the debts incurred by the government. In the terms of the loan, there are some requirements that the Indonesian government have to obey. First is the privatization of government enterprise. This has been done to the majority of state enterprise that were profitable, for example, plantation, telecommunication, and was controlled by foreign capital. The second one is removal of subsidies for the poor and working people. This was done by all government after the fall of Suharto, and the effect is soaring poverty rates in Indonesia. There were compensation provision, but we call them lipstick program because they only cover up the effect and do not solve the problem. So like every month, based on the data, how many people are categorized as poor, then the government will hand them 100,000 rupiah every month. The third one is free trade, introduced proudly by the existing government. The difficulty of farmer in production and marketing was never a concern, rice import being their proud policy. The weak infrastructure of Indonesian industry did not concern them, and they still opened the market for foreign foreign goods. Natural resources also controlled by foreign interests. The national government doesn't try to take a greater advantage from the Indonesian mining products. It just wants to make foreign investor comfortable to exploit Indonesia without much benefit for the people's welfare. So every month there's a new opening of coal mines in the new area of Borneo, with all the benefits going to capital and the existing authorities. The fifth one is investment regulation. Make the investor feel comfortable, providing an investment climate with guarantees of security, especially friendly trade unions and flexible working arrangement. So, related to the neoliberalism in the labor relation, we can see that first, the regulation or legislation, including regional regulation, guarantee employees can offer the lowest possible wage. In determining wage, different wage components are estimated very cheap, and it became a government and capitalist tool to make wage as cheap as legally possible. In addition, by breaking wage down on sectoral basis, the labor is divided. Second one is many of private foundation recruitment is the real form of government support for contracting out and outsourcing. So the labor and employer relationship is no longer direct, but through an intermediary provider. This downgrading of the labor relationship will make labor more easily exploited. Contract employment and outsourcing make it easier for the owners of the company to enforce long working hours and lost benefit for workers and laborers. And it's also easier to fire workers without any compensation. And the most dangerous thing is that labor will be difficult to organize. This becomes a tool of capital through the government's hand in removing the power of trade union in the future. The third one is the packet of law called ProFairness. This stands for Program Pembangunan Nasional or Program of National Development, which is part of neoliberal program. So the ProFairness Act used concept given by IMF, World Bank, and the regional development agencies, claiming that they will eliminate the economic crisis in Indonesia. Besides ProFairness, there is a presidential instruction which promotes capitalist interests. That instruction derived from 2005-2009 development plan of SBY government, which in chapter 23 about employment states that problem of unemployment and investment should be solved by labor market flexibility. The fourth one is the industrial court. After the abolition of 1957 Act and the 64 Act became an Industrial Dispute Settlement Act, is requested in the agenda package of the Indonesian government neoliberal, which is agreed by the IMF at the interest of international capitalists. So the government promotes this Industrial Dispute Act as quick, cheap.
Sorry. Oh. We stop 1 second.
You got this? It's not working. So the government promotes the Industrial Dispute Settlement Act as a quick, cheap, and fair, but it turned out the opposite. It's very complicated, it's not cheap, and more tragically, it is far from a sense of justice. Plus, the main problem is it will take years and years to settle the problem. The industrial court is also a powerful tool used by companies in firing labor, knowing that the workers will be reluctant to use the court. So facing the condition of worsening poverty, not surprisingly, almost every day we hear news of labor action in Indonesia. Some examples are, on 9 December 2009, more than 6,000 workers from Kasbi and other trade union blockade three highway that connect Tangerang City and Banten, which is like a satellite city, Jakarta satellite city. So this blockade started early in the morning and paralyzed Tangerang because not a single transportation could go in or out Tangerang. This was done by workers due to the decision by Tangerang mayor to set minimum wage according to what the businessman association want. The wage is much, much lower than the decent living wage. And since 17 March, Kasbi trade union member from the state-owned oil company, Pertamina in Balongan, in western part of Java, went on strike. And although the police sent full-armed mobile brigade to each and every worker's house, and some workers were beaten, it didn't stop the strike. The workers are demanding to an end to the contract and outsourcing system in Pertamina, and a decent wage. The workers paralyzed almost half of the oil refinery in Balongan. And every Tuesday, in Jakarta Industrial Court, hundreds of careful trade unions, supported by other trade unions, will hold protests demanding an end to contract and outsourcing system in Carrefour supermarket. But neoliberalism has responded to that. The ruling class and the international capital use the most powerful weapon facing a weakened labor movement, that is using the union itself. So today there is only four confederations in Indonesia. The Confederation of Indonesian Prosperous Labor Union, KSBSI, Confederation of All Indonesian Workers Union, KSPSI, Confederation of Indonesia Workers Union, KSPI, and our union movement, the Confederation Congress of Indonesian Union Alliance, KASBI. But only three are given full right by the government, which is KSBSI, KSPSI, and KSPI. Only the first three have representative in the National Tripartite Institution, the Industrial Court, the National Wage Council, and the Labor Security Fund. Giving full rights to this to the first three confederations is not without reason, because they are very faithful in supporting neoliberal policy that oppress the working class and actually also oppress their own members. One example is the Labor Law 2003, which paved the way for labor market flexibility. It was the result of working group involving those three confederations, which that support the law along with the employers' association. And later on 23 November 2009, there was a trade union meeting for political consensus initiated by KSBSI. In that meeting also present KSPSI and KSPI. They supported the result of National Summit, a meeting between the government and the Indonesian Employers Association, which basically laid the ground for future neoliberal policy. They also attempt to build a shared national bipartite forum with the Indonesian Employer Association. So the Indonesian working class struggle is not only against neoliberalism, but also against what we call the yellow trade union. I think it's the same in here, that co-op and restrain the labor movement. The workers have to fight on every battlefield. They must enter all the state institutions in the field of labor to take a position as an opposition. They also must continue to struggle in the factory level to get their basic demand. Lobbying by elite union leaders cannot replace the mass struggle. And in the midst of crisis and because of the type of development in Indonesia, the working class needs to unite their economic struggle with political struggle. So after Suharto fell in 98, there were several attempts by trade union to involve workers in political struggle. First method was for the trade union to build their own political party. The second one is by making a political contract with established political party. But all of those attempts failed because mainly it wasn't supported by their own member, or it was just a deal between the trade union elite and the bourgeoisie party. But there is also another method that workers can use in exercising their struggle for power. So this exercise came out from factory and local political level. Like now in Karawang, another satellite city of Jakarta, there is a trade union front, and at first it is to fight for a decent wage, but now there has been an intense discussion among them. The front realized the need to take control of the local political power, which is the position of mayor, because that position has power in determining workers' wage in Karawang. Now they are preparing themselves by consolidating people's movement in Karawang to contest in the local election through an independent candidate from the working class themselves. Since 1998, there is hundreds of factories being closed, and the workers are always the one who take the entire burden. Their wage is not paid, they will be left unemployed, or their status will be changed to contract or outsourcing workers. So the workers began factory occupation, at first just to demand their basic rights such as wage. But in one factory, PT Istana, after a series of struggle for 1.5 years, the workers decided that they will try to run the production themselves. So PT Istana is a garment factory that produces for famous brands such as Gap, Banana Republic, Adidas, and other famous brands. So in August 2008, the trade union built a factory occupation committee consisting of trade union themselves, progressive lawyer, and my organization, PRP. They then produce t-shirts for trade unions that support them. With ups and downs, the workers are now still struggling to run the factory. Their main problem are capital, of course, material, fuel, and electricity. So this story has inspired other trade union and workers to do the same thing in Indonesia. And with the economic crisis still hitting Indonesia, factories being closed, workers being laid off, the option is to build worker self-management. In worker self-management, the workers learn to control means of production and build a political structure for that control. They also destroy the myth that everywhere if you have workers, then you must always have bosses. So political struggle become important because there is no guarantee of the basic rights of working class if the working class does not hold political power. We can win a decent wage in factory without political power. But the victory can be easily eliminated by the state political decision. In Indonesia, it also became clear that there is no third way. There can be no prosperity and democracy under capitalism. All of Indonesian political economic policy serve the interests of the imperialists. The imperialists wallow in wealth of oil, gas, timber, cheap labor, free tax, while 140 million people of Indonesia live in poverty. Even the slightest effort to provide welfare to the people of Indonesia is confronted by the imperialists. So now, the slogan that echo among the progressive working class is power to the workers, prosperity to the people. Because we understand that the Indonesian working class liberation can only occur when the working class is in power. And in the end, although our struggle in its early stages in national framework, still, we do not conceal our ultimate destination that we have a world to win. We will remember the Australian working class when they courageously blocked the colonial ship coming to Indonesia during our independence struggle. We will remember the brave South African working class when they dismissed Suharto's visit to South Africa. And we will also learn from the spirit of Palestinian people fighting against imperialism and Zionism. And tomorrow, my friend, my comrades, let the ruling class tremble because the gigantic unity of the working class will march in one voice. Socialism or death. Thank you.